Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed especially for English learners. Today on the show, Pete Musto and Ashley Thompson bring you the Higher Education Report. Ana Mateo has words and their stories. Later, we bring you our American History program, The Making of a Nation. But first,
higher education is an important step on the path towards a meaningful, well-paying career in almost every modern job field. But becoming a doctor or scientist, for example, requires much more than just completing difficult classes or passing major exams. For many college students, wide-reaching, long-term research is very important to gain necessary skills and prove one's abilities. A big part of the research process includes getting financial support to cover the costs of the work. Researchers usually raise this money by writing proposals asking outside organizations for a given amount of money, called a grant, to fund their work. These groups consider the value of the work in comparison to the cost to make their decision whether to approve or deny grants. However, a recent study argues that funding organizations do not consider only the quality or possible impact of research when deciding on grant applications. The study suggests that perhaps groups also consider the gender of the applicant. It reports that female researchers receive less grant money on average than males. Experts worry that this could harm the careers of researchers.
Researchers at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, released their findings in the JAMA Network Publishing Service in March. They looked at all the amounts of money the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, gave to first-time grant seekers between 2006 and 2017. The United States government agency offers about $37 billion a year in grants. It is the world's largest public funder of biomedical research. The researchers found that in the 10-year period, projects led by women seeking their first grant received an average grant of $126,615. NIH grants to men seeking their first grant amounted to about $40,000 more on average. Brian Utsi says these differences are harmful in several ways. He is a professor of leadership in the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern. He helped with the study. Utsi notes that getting less money does not just affect a person's ability to complete their research. He notes the ability to earn grant money is very important for a researcher looking to move forward in their career. Many students lead their first major research project while they are seeking a graduate degree of some kind, Utsi says. Colleges and universities may help cover some of the costs of that work. But they want to know if a researcher's work is interesting and valuable to the world at large, and whether or not it will bring in positive attention. Having a group like NIH offer you a grant is a great way to demonstrate that to a school and get the school to continue supporting you, he adds. The more support you have, the better, as the more research you get funded, the more work you will be able to publish.
Publishing is especially important as student researchers work their way into positions as professors, Utsi says. This is a common path, as a job as a professor usually provides a person with plenty of time to do more research. And a major consideration colleges and universities make when employing a professor is how much research that person has already published. In the U.S., some schools offer lifetime positions, known as tenure, to professors who, among other things, have published the most notable research. Utsi argues that there is almost equal amounts of importance placed on funding research as there is on publishing. So any differences in the size of grants women are receiving creates barriers for them. A smaller-than-expected grant may affect the reach of their projects. It can also suggest that their work has less value. And it may even lead to women leaving research positions at colleges and universities in order to avoid the difficulties of publishing entirely. This is not just a problem for these women alone, says Utsi. Lots of research shows that gender diversity on creative teams, on scientific teams, in the classroom, really enhances the rate at which discoveries take place and ideas get discovered and put together in new and different ways, which really helps out everybody in society, he told VOA. The JAMA study did not look at why male and female researchers might receive unequal grants, but Heather Metcalf says she has some ideas. She is chief research officer for the Association for Women in Science.
Metcalf says that throughout her career, she has witnessed unfair treatment of women in science fields. Some of it comes out in the open through bad behavior. Yet there is also a great deal of inequality that many people in these fields fail to recognize. It isn't just isolated incidents that don't have an impact on one another over time. It adds up and has an exponential impact on a person's career, Metcalf noted. For example, she says, the people making the decisions on a grant proposal might see a woman listed as the lead researcher and change their opinion without even knowing they are doing so. Traditional thinking that men are better at science than women is still common, she says, even though there is no research to support that idea. Such cultural lessons are taught at an early age and can even prevent young girls from developing interests in research fields, says Metcalf. She and Brian Utsi both hope this latest study will bring more attention to this form of gender inequality and lead to changes in the grant consideration process. The NIH does operate a special program that works to remove barriers for women in science called Women in Biomedical Careers. VOA has tried to contact the agency several times about the JAMA study. By the time of publication, NIH representatives had not provided any comment on the study. NIH is currently in communication with the researcher to better understand the data presented in the paper. The NIH is not alone in its seemingly unbalanced treatment of male and female researchers. Last year, a study found that the majority of cancer research grants in the United Kingdom went to projects led by men. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Each week on this program, we talk about common words and expressions in the English language. Today, we talk about the word knock. To help explain expressions using knock, you will hear scripted dialogues. We will also use songs. We really want to knock your socks off. In other words, we want to have such an effect on you that your socks fly off your feet, so to speak. Another expression with a similar meaning is knock 'em dead. Usually, we say this to close friends or family members when we want them to do a really great job at something. It is an easygoing, informal way to give someone motivation. So if a friend has a very important meeting, you can say to her, "Don't worry, you will knock 'em dead." In other words, you are going to impress them so much that they will fall over dead. Not actually, of course. The EM in this expression is short for the word them. But when saying this expression, we don't say them. We say the informal shortened form of the word, pronounced M. And we say it quickly, blending the words together, knock 'em dead. Now, as a verb, knock has many meanings. The most common is to simply knock on something or hit it with your fist. For example, you knock on a door when you want to enter someone's house. That you probably know. But did you know that when you want good luck, you should knock on wood? Knock on wood is something we either do or say, or both, to bring good luck. This custom may come from ancient times when people believed that gods existed in nature. So, for example, knocking on a tree was thought to bring good luck. Even if they don't believe it to be true, many Americans say knock on wood to mean wish me good luck. Now, another way we use knock as a verb is to combine it with the word around. To knock around is to walk around without a clear purpose. So you can knock around your neighborhood, a ball field, or city streets. One day on a visit to New York City, I knocked around Central Park for a good 2 hours. And it was not a waste of time. So don't knock me for spending so much time knocking around. And this brings us to yet another meaning of the word knock. It also means to criticize. If you knock something, you find fault with it. So if someone criticizes your career choice, you can say, "Why are you knocking my job? It's my business what I do, not yours." We use this meaning of knock in another informal expression. Don't knock it till you've tried it. This means you should not criticize something you have not tried. Another common expression is to simply tell someone to knock it off. This is a forceful and somewhat childish way to say stop it. There is another knock expression that we use only in special situations. So let's say somebody wants to do something and you really don't care if they do it or if they don't. In that case, you could say, knock yourself out. Let's hear it used in these two short dialogues.
Wow, your sandwich looks good.
It is good, but I'm full.
Can I finish the rest?
Knock yourself out.
Hey, are you going to be home this weekend?
Yes. Why do you ask?
Well, I want to throw a party. Since you're my roommate, I thought I'd check with you first.
I don't care.
Are you sure? It might be loud.
Knock yourself out.
On the formal-informal scale, if we were to have one, this term would rate as very informal. So only use it with your good friends and not your employer, your friend's grandparents, or a university professor. Speaking of university, some people go there to learn, while others learn from experience. And difficult experiences can be the best teacher. In a way, they are a lot like school. And we call that school the School of Hard Knocks. In the School of Hard Knocks, you learn something as a result of difficult or unpleasant experiences. The term hard knocks means the situations in life that try to knock you down, but you won't give up. And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The United States Constitution guarantees freedoms such as freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of religion. The Bill of Rights in the Constitution protects these and other individual rights. But the government has not always honored all of the rights in the Constitution. In the 1700s, for example, President John Adams supported laws to stop Thomas Jefferson and the Democratic Party from criticizing the government. During the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln took strong actions to prevent newspapers from printing military news. And during the 1950s, Senator Joseph McCarthy accused innocent people of being communists and traitors. Some of the most serious government attacks on personal rights took place in 1919 and 1920. A number of government officials took sometimes unlawful actions against labor leaders, foreigners, and others. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe discuss the campaign that came to be known as the Red Scare.
These actions took place because of American fears about the threat of communism. Those fears were tied closely to the growth of the organized labor movement during World War I. There were a number of strikes during the war. More and more often, workers were willing to risk their jobs and join together to try to improve working conditions. President Woodrow Wilson had long supported organized labor, and he tried to get workers and business owners to negotiate peacefully. But official support for organized labor ended when strikes closed factories that were important to the national war effort. President Wilson and his advisors felt workers should put the national interest before their private interest. They told workers to wait until after the war to demand more pay and better working conditions.
In general, American workers did wait. But when the war finally ended in 1918, American workers began to strike in large numbers for higher pay. As many as 2 million workers went on strike in 1919. There were strikes by house builders, meat cutters, and train operators. And there were strikes in the shipyards, the shoe factories, and the telephone companies. Most striking workers wanted the traditional goals of labor unions: more pay and shorter working hours. But a growing number of them also began to demand major changes in the economic system itself. They called for government control of certain private industries. Railroad workers, for example, wanted the national government to take permanent control of running the trains. Coal miners, too, demanded government control of their industry. And even in the conservative grain farming states, 200,000 farmers joined a group that called for major economic changes.
All these protests came as a shock to traditional Americans, who considered their country to be the home of free business. They saw little need for labor unions, and they feared that the growing wave of strikes meant the United States faced the same revolution that had just taken place in Russia. After all, Lenin himself had warned that the Bolshevik Revolution would spread to workers in other countries. Several events in 1919 only increased this fear of violent revolution. A bomb exploded in the home of a senator from the southeastern state of Georgia, and someone even exploded a bomb in front of the home of Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, the nation's chief law officer. However, the most frightening event was a strike by police in Boston, Massachusetts. The policemen demanded higher wages, but the police chief refused to negotiate with them. As a result, the policemen went on strike. When they did, thieves began to break into unprotected homes and shops. Massachusetts Governor Calvin Coolidge finally had to call out state troops to protect the people. His action defeated the strike. Most of the policemen lost their jobs.
All this was too much for many Americans. They began to accuse labor unions and others of planning a revolution. And they launched a forceful campaign to protect the country from these suspected extremists. Leaders of this campaign accused thousands of people of being communists or Reds. The campaign became known as the Red Scare. Of course, most people were honestly afraid of revolution. They did not trust the many foreigners who were active in unions, and they were tired of change and social unrest after the bloody World War. A number of these Americans in different cities began to take violent actions against people and groups that they suspected of being communist extremists. In New York, a crowd of men in military uniforms
attacked the office of a socialist newspaper. They beat the people working there and destroyed the equipment. In the western city of Centralia, Washington, 4 people were killed in a violent fight between union members and their opponents. Public feeling was against the labor unions and political leftists. Many people considered anyone with leftist views to be a revolutionary trying to overthrow democracy. Many state and local governments passed laws making it a crime to belong to organizations that supported revolution. 28 states passed laws making it a crime to wave red flags.
People also demanded action from the national government. President Wilson was sick and unable to see the situation clearly. He cared about little except his dream of the United States joining the new League of Nations. But Attorney General Palmer heard the calls for action. Palmer hoped to be elected president the next year. He decided to take strong actions to gain the attention of voters. One of Palmer's first actions as Attorney General was to prevent coal miners from going on strike. Next, he ordered a series of raids to arrest leftist leaders. A number of these arrested people were innocent of any crime, but officials kept many of them in jail without charges for weeks. Palmer expelled from the country a number of foreigners suspected of revolutionary activity. He told reporters that communists were criminals who planned to overthrow everything that was good in life.
Feelings of fear and suspicion extended to other parts of American life. Many persons and groups were accused of supporting communism. Such famous Americans as actor Charlie Chaplin, educator John Dewey, and law professor Felix Frankfurter were among those accused. The Red Scare caused many innocent people to be afraid to express their ideas. They feared they might be accused of being a communist. But as quickly as the Red Scare swept across the country, so too did it end in 1920. In just a few months, people began to lose trust in Attorney General Palmer. They became tired of his extreme actions. Republican leader Charles Evans Hughes and other leading Americans called for the Justice Department to obey the law in arresting and charging people.
By the summer of 1920, the Red Scare was over. Even a large bomb explosion in New York in September did not change the opinion of most Americans that the nation should return to free speech and the rule of law. The Red Scare did not last long, but it showed that many Americans, after World War I, were tired of social changes. They wanted peace and business growth.
And that's our show. Hope you return tomorrow to Learning English on The Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver.